We're in our study, of course, on Wednesday nights, though, in the book of Ecclesiastes. We come to a portion that's a familiar portion. In fact, I grew up listening to a lot of different groups on the radio, but to date me, of course, one of those groups early on were the Byrds. Some of you may remember that name, but they're basically known for one song, and it was a song taken from Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 1 to 11. There is a season, turn, 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 you know, that song that came from Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Well, this is a very interesting section that we'll look at tonight, chapter 3, verses 1 to 11, because it reminds us of a commodity that each one of us has. And this commodity that we have, each one of us has the same amount of it if we're just going to look at it from a daily sort of basis. It doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor or young or old, single or married, we're all alike in this. You can be employed, you can be jobless, you can be a student, you can be the president of the United States. It doesn't matter. We're all on equal ground as far as this issue goes, this commodity. What is that one thing that we all have that's the same? It's time. This is a section where he addresses time. We are each day given the same amount of time. Now, I understand there's a point when we die, but we basically live life, each one of us, with the same amount of time every day. No matter what your income is, if you're rich or if you're not, the two of you, each of you in that example, are given the same amount of this by God every day. Okay? How many seconds is that, do you know, in a day? It is 86,400 seconds. God, in a sense, deposits in our life account every day 86,400 seconds. That comes out to 1,440 minutes. But I like to think of it in terms of seconds. 86,400 seconds. God gives each of us this amount of time each day to use. And there's no carryover. In other words, there's no amount of it that if you don't use it, is going to be carried over to the next day. If you don't use it, what you don't use, so to speak, is lost. So it's a precisely determined amount of time. And you can spend it only once. This is a very amazing topic, this idea of time. It many times is a frustrating topic, time. And even though we talk about it, even though we frequently check it, I was living my life today, surrounded by the importance of time, of catching flights and boarding flights and catching the next flight and fighting the traffic in Dallas to get to the airport on time in the rain and all that. Time was very conscious of it. Even though we talk about it and frequently check it, it's actually a tough word to define. I mean, how would you define that word, time? One person defined it this way. It's a thought-provoking statement. It's a stretch of duration. A stretch of duration in which things happen. Very philosophical way of looking at it. Benjamin Franklin said this about time. He said, quote, "It's the stuff life is made of." That's what time is. The stuff life is made of. Well, that's true. Our lives revolve around it. But regardless how we try to define it, we know that it is significant. We know that it is valuable because it's completely irretrievable. We don't get any of it back. You can never relive it, whatever it is. You can never repeat it. I like sports, and I like the technology that comes along with sports. My youngest daughter likes football, and that thrills my heart. She likes to watch football. But, you know, one of the things that have come with technology is the instant replay. The instant replay. Well, in life, there is no such thing as an instant replay. You don't get that. There's only one shot at it. Only one call that can be made. Never relived, never repeated those seconds that you're given. So it really is something temporary. And since it is temporary, and since it is so valuable, then obviously we do need to invest it wisely. We do need to find ways to enjoy it while it's ours. Well, Solomon, in the book of Ecclesiastes, in this personal journal of his, as I've described it to you, this journal of his search for significance, his search for meaning and purpose in life, in this journal, he now brings in this subject. We come to this chapter where he pauses from the discussion of the journey long enough to write this practical analysis of time. Now, he's been making the point along the way, as we've seen, that a person is not able to enjoy life apart from God. That's the bottom line of the book. There's a lot of joy in life. There is purpose in life. There is meaning. But not apart from God. All the pursuits that a person might think are going to bring them meaning and purpose, they're all futility. They're vanity. If God is left out, if you only live your life under the sun, he says, horizontally and not vertically. But after pondering that whole idea, Solomon gives us what is really a wonderful section of Hebrew poetry. This is called Hebrew Wisdom Poetry. And in this poem, it's a Hebrew poem, in this wisdom poetry, he breaks life and time down into these measurable portions or events. Verse 1. There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven. This is his opening line, the opening line of the poetry. And then following this, after this statement that sets it up, following it is a list. There are 14 contrasts in life. All of them, as we'll see, and I can't really explain all that he had in mind by each one that he gives us, but we'll certainly see that they're all familiar scenes to us. This is the stuff life is made of. These times, these epochs, these seasons. What we see in verse 8 is really a cross-section of life. Not everything is here. I mean, not everything could possibly be included in these contrasts. But it's pretty remarkable, I think, just how pervasive these opposites are. They're pervasive in our lives. There's an appointed time for everything. And with that word appointed, he's indicating that he's certainly affirmed God's sovereignty. He's affirming that God's sovereignty is expressed in his providence as he works out his will. So with that term, he's actually arguing this thesis here that every action of man, every event, everything we experience is going to be traced to its ultimate source some way. And that is this all-embracing plan that is being administered by God. These seasons of life, these times, are appointments from God in our lives and in the world. All the affairs of life, he argues, the preacher he calls himself in this book, for all the affairs of life, God has set a time. Well, let's walk through these 14 contrasts that describe what our lives consist of. Verse 2, he really begins with the most momentous events of human life. He mentions them first. There's a time to give birth and a time to die. Some translations have a time to be born, but it is more accurate to say in this Hebrew phrase, it's a time to give birth. I mean, this is reminding us that we really don't have ultimate control over either one of those. They're appointments. God appoints your birthday, and God appoints the day of your death. He has a day appointed when he calls your name, as Psalm 90 says, and he says, "Return, O man, to dust." That's an appointment. And this is an all-inclusive observation. I mean, this is the most all and obvious and all-inclusive observation anybody can make about life in the human world, that there's birth and there's death. And we just don't have ultimate control over them. So the first statement has to do with the entirety of our human existence. There's a beginning and there's an end. Okay, that's a time. So it's an illustration then of the comprehensiveness of the plan of God. His appointments, his sovereign control is comprehensive. That's the first statement that's made here. It also reminds us of something that Solomon already admitted that he struggled with. and that is the fact of human mortality. He's already been dealing with that. He's used illustrations from nature and the creation and the world and pursuits in life to keep coming back to this issue that our lives are short. We are mortal. So here it is, once again, man's mortality, the fact of human mortality. So this is not only a statement about God's sovereignty here. In it, we find the reality of the brevity of all of our events, the brevity and the lack of permanence of human activity in that little statement. There's a time appointed by God to give birth and a time to die. And that sovereignty and the scope of his plan even spills over into the rest of creation there. And he uses the point of the life of plants and says God's over that, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. And we may not be actual farmers here tonight, but we still all understand the principle here that you have to cooperate with the seasons when it comes to plants and growth. It's the only way to get a crop. You don't plant when it's harvest time, and you don't harvest at the wrong time either. And you even have to be careful with other things related to this. You have to be careful with pruning. You can't just prune any way you want, any time you want. Especially with certain types of trees and fruit trees, etc. You can't just prune it whenever you feel like it if you really want it to prosper. And when the fruit's ripe on the tree, it's got to be picked promptly at the right time. Timing is everything when it comes to the field. And all that timing, everything involved in the planting and the uprooting of what is planted, even that part of our existence, things that we deal with, it's all under God's care. It's the stuff life consists of. By the way, all these statements actually have metaphorical meanings to them. It's not just each one of them. They're broader than in the meaning than what they just say. That's the way this Hebrew poetry works. And so there's a way to metaphorically look at that statement even on a personal level. There are times when it's time to move on. I mean, your life changes. There's a time to uproot yourself. That happens in life. But maybe you think it's time to do that and you can't because things in life just don't fall into place. And there are other times when you're convinced you're going to be someplace forever and there's no uprooting in my plans. And lo and behold, in God's providence, maybe just months later, you find yourself hundreds of miles away. You know, life changes. God has a way of planting us and uprooting us, and he does it all the time in his providence. That's what he does. So all of this have these metaphorical type meanings, and there's a good example of that. Verse 3, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up. Here we just have a broad statement about all the different pursuits and activities of men that can be destructive or creative, destructive or constructive. Time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down, a time to build up. We don't necessarily like those negative parts there. A time to kill. But think about life, human existence. Destruction and killing are part of life. We don't avoid that in our world. We prefer the healing and the building up side of all this. There's a time to kill and a time to heal. He's just asserting that in the world in which we live, death is a central fact of life. And there are times where that is even takes place through killing. A lot of scholars have tried to determine, you know, all that Solomon had in mind with all these statements. And it's very difficult, actually. It could be referring even to the condemnation of murderers by the state, the whole idea of the penalty of death. There's a time to kill. Some are against that in our world, but nevertheless, it is embraced in the plan of God. We do find it in Scripture. This idea of capital punishment on behalf of the state. It's not for you to take in your own hands. So he says, you know, that's included in this broad statement. There's a time for that. There's a time for executing murderers. Why? Well, because man is made in God's image. Find that in Genesis 9, verse 6, and other places, man made in God's image. If you think of it that way, then to kill another person, you're actually killing God in effigy, so to speak. You know, you're taking a life, you're taking the image of God and killing it. So there's an alternative then, a prerogative and a responsibility that the state is given, God's duly authorized agent in such a case. In order to show respect for God, I'm not saying that the state is thinking that way anymore, but to show respect for God and for the value of the image of God in man, by if someone else is killed, then the state has the prerogative and responsibility to take the murderer's life. There's a time for that. The plan of God includes a time to heal. Literally, it means to sew or to heal a wound. You can repair something, but it's to heal a wound. And so life consists of that as well, both the negative and the positive. There's a time to tear down. Sometimes in our lives, the things that we've used or enjoyed, there comes a time where you have to do away with them. Change is necessary in our world. This thing we live in called time includes, in God's providence, change that happens. Items are destroyed. I mean, we see it in the building world that demolition crews are then followed by construction crews. Our life consists of that sort of thing, that constant change of tearing down and building up. There's blasting of structures. I saw that on the news this morning, actually. It was very timely because when we landed Monday, we left the airport, Robin and Joe and I, and we drove by Six Flags over Texas and told them about some of my childhood memories there. And there's a big tower there, and I pointed out that I have a relative that was in a show on that tower. He played the Riddler in a Batman show, and he was rappelling down that tower and stuff like that. They hired him because he could do that. And this morning, they blew it up. And so knocked it down, because they're going to build something else. It's like that in our world. Change happens. Things we're accustomed to get destroyed. Things we're used to, things we've encountered as valuable. Something new is built. A new form takes the place of what is old. And there's something metaphorical about that, see, in our lives, beyond just buildings and towers. There are things in our lives that get wiped out. Things in our lives that we're accustomed to that we don't have anymore, that change. And something takes its place. Life is made up of that. Verse 4 has to do with human emotions. First half is that private side of human emotions, a time to weep and a time to laugh. And on the other side, more the public side of that, a time to mourn and a time to dance. Human emotions in God's providence are the sorrows and the joys that go along with what we've just talked about in verses 2 and 3. If you think about it, time to give birth and time to die, there's joy in one and there's sorrow in the other. Time to plant and uproot, there could be a contrast of joy and sorrow there. Time to kill and a time to heal, certainly joy and sorrow. Tearing down, losing things, change coming, new things being built up, there could be joy and sorrow. It's just a part of life. If you think about it, without one, either one, the other one is not easily recognized. Without sorrow, you don't completely appreciate joy. And without joy, you don't completely understand the pain of sorrow. He lists weeping first. And there's possibly a reason for that due to the poetry. The Hebrew word for weep, if you pronounced it, sounds very similar to the word build up, which was the last word of verse 3. There's this carryover of the sound by the words that he chose. Maybe we could even use an ocean metaphor here, that there are times in our lives where there are low tides. So you can speak metaphorically about that, the low tides of life. And those are hard times, times where you feel unfruitful, times when you feel doubt, times when you feel insecurity, even pain. C.S. Lewis said this about pain. He said, pain is God's megaphone. He says he whispers to us in our pleasure, but he shouts to us in our pain. Louder messages get sent through times of suffering, sorrow. And sometimes those moments of weeping and sorrow can be extreme in our lives. There are some things that happen that are more serious and tragic than other things. Extreme suffering, extreme weeping and sorrow. But fortunately, the other side is true as well. Time to laugh. Divine providence brings us times of pleasure, times of joy, times of even laughter. I like what Spurgeon said about laughter. I mean, he's a great preacher, an intense preacher, a profound preacher, a powerful preacher, and yet he didn't oppose humor even in preaching. Everybody likes to quote Spurgeon because he had so many great things he said, but here's one. About preaching, he said, "It is less a crime to cause a momentary laughter than a half hour of profound slumber." Something to think about there. We need to laugh. And God allows us those times, and He brings those times to us. A sense of humor is important in this world. I get around people that have no sense of humor whatsoever. I wonder about their understanding of the joy and the times of pleasure that God brings. I want my children to remember me as someone who loved the things that are important and, you know, migrated toward profound things in life. I want that. But frankly, I want them to remember me as someone who was fun to live with, you know, as well. In the second half of this, it's the same kind of idea of human emotions, but it's more the public side of what goes on when tragedy and rejoicing happens. But there's a progression of intensity here. From the first part of verse 4 to the second part, there's this progression of intensity. It intensifies now, not just weeping, but now he says that negative side is a time to mourn. That's referring to those more serious, tragic times. There are those times in life where we lose a family member. There's grief. We don't like those times. We don't like to think about those times. Those who are dearest to us, you know, no longer being around. And other tragic things that happen in life when parents divorce and children have to endure their results of that. There's grief in these times. There's mourning in these times. But he says that times of mourning actually then turn into times of something else. He uses a Hebrew word that you might have expected him to say rejoice, you know, a time to mourn and a time to rejoice. But he actually uses a word that means to leap and to dance. And so it's just a way of saying it, you know, to the max degree, but also because of the poetry, this word that he used that means to leap or to dance, he probably used it instead of rejoice because it sounds like the word to mourn. If you said it in Hebrew, there's a similarity of sound between mourn and this word. So he picked one that would sound like that as part of the poetry. And we see that in life. Now, in the very same family, there can be this tragic event and the loss of a family member in a funeral where they're burying that family member. And then maybe even a year or less later, that same family at the reception of the daughter who's getting married now. And there's that rejoicing. There's that leaping. There's that dancing. How quickly, in these appointed times, the scene of mourning can change to dancing. Verse 5, there's a pair there, or two pairs that deal with the whole idea of friendship and enmity. And this is the most difficult one out of the whole section, by the way, to understand what Solomon had in mind. And a lot of scholars debate over this and propose things of what he means by a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. But I think the best way to look at it is it fits somehow with the second half, a time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. It's another way to say something about friendships and relationships and getting rid of relationships. But it is that primarily that idea of showing friendship or enmity. There's this idea of gathering stones. That's overall the concept of building a friendship. It's akin to building a friendship. There's the idea of casting stones or enmity. That's suggesting something negative against forming a friendship, ending a friendship. Some have suggested there's even a military or a national nuance to this, that it's friendship and enmity on a national military level, that the gathering of stones could refer to the preparing of the way for a military conqueror who's coming, and casting stones is referring to military aggression in some way. Some have suggested that even it was referring to something they would do back in that day, that when they were in the war, they would take stones and cover the enemy's fields with them, so they would ruin the fields that way. Well, whether or not there's a national or military nuance here, still the overall concept seems to fit with the second half here. It's that concept, metaphorically, of friendships, either gathering stones or throwing stones, the ending of relationships. The second half kind of is more clear, though. Something about relationships, something about people, a time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. There is this discussion of embracing here, times of affirmation, the idea where someone would, that you know, somebody close to you or a friend that literally is encouraging you somehow. You know, they draw you close. They give you a hug. They give you a word of encouragement. Something maybe that you need at that time. And then there are that times where that even that same person may confront you with hard truth. It's not a time for embracing. It's a time to shun embracing, and there's something implied there that you're doing the opposite. Instead of embracing, instead of drawing somebody close and saying words of endearment to them, there's the need for confrontation, hard truth. For a life to stay balanced, you really need both of those. Verse 6, a time to search, a time to give up is lost, a time to keep, a time to throw away. These seem to go together. Now talking about possessions in some way and our perspective of that. And the resolutions concerning possessions, depending on what happens to them. A time to search, a time to give up is lost. That word search also has the nuance of meaning in Hebrew of getting. There's a time to get things, even new things. There's a time of procuring things, buying things, getting new things. It can mean that. And there's the time of letting things go, losing things. That's part of the meaning there. But also is that idea of looking for something that you already have in order to keep it. You know, you're searching for something because you already see it as something valuable and it's important to you. And so maybe you can't find it. You search for it. We're very familiar with the idea of rescue squads. We saw that in California a lot, frequent searches in the mountains. And at some point, even though this person has disappeared for days and now a week and 2 weeks perhaps, there's at some point where an expert decides that the search has to end. And you see this family devastated, and there's a time to give up, is lost. And they're devastated because they feel like they're deserting their loved one. You know, they can't get over that feeling that I'm deserting them out there by not looking for them anymore. All that's included in these metaphorical statements that Solomon has given to us. A time to get things and a time to even search for things that you already own. A time to let go of things, not getting, but letting go of things. Or giving up something is lost. It's not important to me anymore. Time to keep. Time to throw away. That makes me think of my garage, actually. Makes me think of my closet. Perhaps it does you. Some things you just don't throw away. Some things you'd rather die than part with. Isn't it interesting how practical Solomon is in his own life? I mean, this is what his life was like, too. There's a time to keep things. Keep things that we think are important. You know, those things you'd rather die than part with, like those things that find their way into your attic or your basement and you don't ever look at again. But there is a time, on the other hand, when you can no longer cram one more thing into that attic or one more garment into that closet and one more item into that garage. And so it's necessary to, unless you expand the house, you know, you've got to give up things. You've got to let things go from that standpoint. Throw them away. That means more than just throwing in the dumpster. It's you're going to give it away or are you going to throw it away? You clean it out. Metaphorically, there's that time of ridding yourself of any kind of excess baggage. And you get a fresh start on life. Again, remember, it's poetry. You get a fresh start on life. There's a time to keep, but there's a time to start over. Clean it all out. Get a fresh start. Begin again. How many fresh starts are there like that in our lives? Maybe many in the course of our lives. I've done that personally. cleaned out my life in some way and started over. Hard to do, but necessary. There's nothing in this world is ours forever, whether it's possessions or something else. Verse 7, a time to tear apart and a time to sew together. I think that's more indication of the various destructive and creative activities of man. What you have here is the tearing apart that represents various destructive activities and the sewing together representing creative activities. Once again, it's the reality of change. In that sense, there are times to change through destroying and repairing. But the language also fits something else that happened in Solomon's day. When bad news came, it was appropriate in his day that you would literally rip your clothing. You'd rip the front of your garments. That was a way of displaying your grief. And there's a good example of that in 2 Samuel 13, verse 31. 2 Samuel 13, 31, it says, then the king arose, tore his clothes, and lay on the ground. And all his servants were standing by with clothes torn. You read Job, that's what his friends did. Job's friends, when they came, they tore their clothes and they sat in silence. And that kind of fits then, if that's what Solomon had in mind, it does fit the second half of that verse. There's a time to tear apart. In other words, there's a time to be sober about things because of what's happened and a time to be silent along with that. Could be what he had in mind. With the passing of the problem, then it's proper to sew the torn clothes together again. Freely converse again. But that second part, a time to be silent, a time to speak, has further application of the destructive activities of man, though. And helpful activities in life, because our tongues can be the most destructive or most helpful parts of our body. Comes to our speech, there are times when it's best to remain silent. In the heat of adversity sometimes. Wisdom is keeping silent. Proverbs even says that even a fool is thought to be silent when he doesn't speak. He's thought to be wise when he's silent, when he doesn't speak. There are times when you can't keep silent. You have to speak out. You have to cry out, even if it's to no one else but God. You're responsible for declaring truth, responsible for declaring your convictions. Be true to your character, you speak truth as you understand it. That's another difficult verse along with verse 5 to know all that he had in mind here. Whether it was the destructive and creative kind of things in life and how the tongue does that, or whether it's that idea of the mourning and the tearing apart of your clothes and the silence that go with that, and then the getting over the mourning and time to speak again. Very hard to know for certain what he meant by that. Could have been that bereavement. Verse 8, I'm just flying through these with you, has to do with personal affections. That's part of our lives, the stuff that life is made up of. A time to love and a time to hate. People are placed in situations in which they are stirred to love or they're moved to hate. You've experienced that. I mean, people many times only think of the love side as being something valuable. And we have such a warped definition of love in our world that people are in love with love and they don't even know what it means. It's almost this unthinking, gullible, non-discerning kind of loving of anything. Solomon recognizes, but there's a time to hate. He's not talking about sinful hating, but there's a time to hate things that God hates. There's a time to hate injustice. There's a time to hate acts of prejudice and inequities of this world that we run across. There's a time to hate. It ought to be hated. They ought to be withstood. So our affections change like that. We find ourselves moved that way in our souls by the things that we read. We get stirred up against injustice and against those who hate God and say things against God. We get stirred up against that. And we get moved to the point of tears of things that happen in life that have to do with sentimental things and things that we love. Our lives consist of all these emotions. He takes that idea of emotions and now brings it definitely to a national level. There's a time for war and a time for peace. Time for war and a time for peace. Sometimes in Hebrew and Greek too, we have what we call a chiastic structure. Sometimes it's pronounced chiastic structure. C-H-I-A-S-T-I-C, chiastic. A chiasm. This is one. A chiasm is a four-part statement. There's an A, a B, a C, and a D. So all of these have this, but a time to love, that would be A. A time to hate, that would be B. A time for war, that's C. A time for peace is D. Chiasm means that the first one and the second one are similar, and the two in the middle, the B and the C, are similar. And that's what we have here. He starts with love, and the good one, and he ends with the good one. And in the middle, sandwiched, are the two negatives. Time to hate, followed by time to war, that's something more on the national level. And he says that in this world, there are appointed times for that as well. War and peace. Even war is part of God's providence in some way. And I understand that a war can be really only the result of greed and pride. I mean, that causes wars. But there also is a such thing as a just war in Scripture. There are just wars in our world. When tyranny runs roughshod over people and the rights of mankind, war sometimes ends up being necessary, whether we like it or not. It's the fact of life. It's something that is part of life. We have an expression. It is what it is. That's what he's described here in these eight verses. It's life. Life. And when you look at this list, one of the things that it kind of wells up in me is the recognition that there's a tension with all these kinds of back and forth sort of events in life and affections that change and our perspectives that change and things we like and then things we have to let go of and things we clean out to have fresh starts. And there's times of grief and then dancing. I mean, all of that, there's this tension almost because sometimes we don't know which is the appropriate reaction in any given circumstance. I mean, sometimes we know what to do, but yet maybe the timing's not right for it. To do the right thing at the wrong time can be just as inappropriate as failing to do the right thing at all. So it's hard to know what season we're in. Is this a season for starting over and letting go? Is it a season for cleaning out? Is it a season for holding on to things and just gritting our teeth and waiting for the next season to come? I understand we don't always know what time it is, but nevertheless, the point is still there. Whether we know it or not, we look back, this is what our life is made of. So because of all that, two questions then emerge. These all-encompassing questions. Verse 9. There's the first one. What profit is there then? What profit is there? What's to be gained from this whole scene that I've just gone through? Once again, that takes you right back to chapter 1, verse 3. He starts the book with that. What advantage does man have in his work, which he does under the sun? We saw it last week. He asked it again. Chapter 2, verse 22. What does a man get in all this labor and his striving with which he labors under the sun? Here he asks it again. It's the obvious question. When you look at life from a season standpoint, look at it from an event standpoint, a time standpoint, what's the profit? Let's go back and use that 86,400 second thing again. That's what you were given. By the end of the day, what's been the profit? What's left of it? Since these are contrasts, and there's an equal number of positives and negatives in here. If you have an equal number of positives and negatives, and you add them together, you end up with zero. Okay. They cancel out. It's almost a mathematical statement that he's making here. It all cancels out. And the net result of life is just zero. I mean, that's not only the point of this section, but we've already seen that's the point of the whole, that's part of the point of the theme of the book. If it's under the sun, the message of the entire journal, under the sun, when you boil it down to its basics and you put yourself into it and you measure it by 86,400 seconds a day, when it's all done, that sounds like a lot because you get a lot of those kind of 86,400 seconds. It all comes up to zero for you. That's what's in it for you. If the trip, back in verse 2, the one we started with, between birth and death, all these other things we read following that through verse 8, all come between those two things. All the other things we said come between those two, birth and death. If your trip from the one to the other is strictly horizontal, it's all zero. If you leave God out of the scene, it wouldn't matter if you had 86,000 seconds, 86 million seconds, 86 bazillion, gazillion, trillion. Still zero if God's left out. It'd still be profitless. Second question. What's the purpose then? Where's life going? What's the purpose? And can man solve this problem? Can he figure it out some way? We talked about education earlier in chapter 2, but let's bring that up again. I mean, can he figure this out? Can he take this math? I mean, you can study math in school. There's bound to be a mathematical answer here. And he can go to the university and get a higher degree, can't he? No. You won't learn from the universities where life's going. You won't learn in institutions of higher learning how to solve this mathematical zero problem. In fact, this is a side point, in our universities, in institutions of so-called higher learning, you're actually considered some sort of intellectual midget. You're considered incompetent if you end up, through that experience, coming to hard and fast conclusions about anything. The whole point is not to come to hard and fast conclusions. To say that truth is authoritative and that there's a right and a wrong. You're not supposed to answer questions. The whole system is built toward just asking questions. You raise questions. You don't solve them. That's our humanistic world. It's a strange kind of way of thinking. This sophisticated sort of idea that you're getting brighter and brighter when you know less and less about things. You know, just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The more increasingly confused you are about truth, then the brighter you've become now. No, you know, really, Ecclesiastes is helping us know that, you know, God's people actually can answer these questions. The answer is clear. It goes back to the very first verse. All of this life is unfolding under the appointment of God, the appointment of providence. Birth, death, growth, harvesting, joy, sorrows, losing, acquiring, speaking up, keeping silent, war, peace, all of it is under the appointment of providence. Verse 10, I've seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. The Hebrew here is very, very complex. It literally is this. I've seen all the business that God has afflicted man with. That's the idea. He's given them the business here to do, and it's a way that has afflicted them. It's just not occupying them. It's afflicting them. It's a stronger term. I mean, work is not simply just a part of our existence and part of nature. It's an affliction. Because the end result of the labor is futility. I've seen this business that God's given the sons of men. I've seen it. They're occupying themselves with it, but it's beyond being occupied with. They're being afflicted by it because they work and they work and they strive and they strive and they come up with zero still. That's part of what human mortality means. Human mortality is broader than just the fact that we die. It means that we live in death. All of our efforts are affected by death. All of our efforts are nullified. Our life is nullified at the end, and all of our efforts along the way are nullified. Nothing man does on his own is going to profit anything ultimately. So he's raising those questions. I mean, what's the purpose? What's the profit? What's the profit in all this? What's the purpose? Because I've looked at it. Well, he gives conclusions as well, verse 11. Not just questions. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He also set eternity in their heart. Yes, so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. Concluding statement here. God has made everything appropriate in its time. That word appropriate, and your translation may have this, it can be translated beautiful. If you have beautiful, you need to know that it can be translated appropriate. So whichever one you have, it has both those meanings. Appropriately beautiful. Beautifully appropriate. When God gives this perspective we need, when we're not just living horizontally, but we're living vertically, and for us that means to have the mind of God and perspective of God, we get it here in Scripture. This is where we get it. It's not a mystical thing that happens. We know His mind only one way, and only the part of His mind that He wants us to know, and that's what He's revealed in Scripture. But when He gives us that perspective we need, when we see life from His perspective and through the grid of His sovereignty and His providence, our times then do become sensible. It all becomes appropriate. It all makes sense. It's meaningful, and it's even beautiful. I listened on the last flight of my leg of the flight today from Charlotte to Greensboro. It's just a little, you go up and you come right back down, so it's not a whole lot of time, but I listened to somebody living in the futility of life sitting right in front of me, telling the woman next to her that she's realized, I need to get more in touch with myself. I need to just get more within myself and understand self and get in touch with myself more. And I've got the little throw up bag there, and I'm getting nauseated, as I'm hearing all this stuff, and I assume that's what they put them in there for. I mean, out there just chasing after meaning, but missing it because they're missing this. They're not making sense. It's not sensible. And she's going to have to move on from this approach to something else because this one's going to come to a dead end, just like every other approach she's been on. But that's the one she's in right now. Validate myself. I don't even know that. It didn't even make sense, what the words. But we get God's perspective. Our times are sensible, they're meaningful, they're beautiful. When all it falls together, when the pieces of the puzzle fit with one another, it's this thing of beauty. It's a beautiful plan. Yet people don't comprehend it because of their prevailing worldliness and their thinking. I mean, we miss everything when we fail to see God's timing, when we don't see it through His perspective. If I look at life strictly as it's laid out before me, all this stuff that's going to continue happening in my life, if I fail to see it through the lens of faith and the lens of God's sovereignty, I can even end up being angry at God. And that's what happens with people. They get angry with Him because of all these things. But through His eyes, something beautiful. We end up, as God's people, giving Him praise because we see purpose in tragedy. I see reason in meaning, even in calamity. His sovereign hand always at work, reminding me that He's in charge. And things that happen in my life that just drive me then to acknowledge that my dependence upon Him. That's what He does with them. And He brings me through these places and into these times of life and into these situations where I relinquish then the controls to Him because I've tried to take control back in some way. I mean, if we accept life the way it is, the stuff of life, it is what it is, but it's not from a standpoint of defeatism, but from a positive standpoint that He's appointed and He's in control, then even the hard parts become bearable. He's made everything appropriate in its time. And another conclusion here by Solomon, He's put or set eternity in man's hearts. We have, all humans, have this curiosity about our future. You know what this woman was really expressing? She didn't use the words, but she's trying to find meaning and purpose in life. And she's dealing with the reality that built within her is a sense of eternity. Something about the future. I've got to figure it out. Where my life is headed. God didn't put that in the hearts of animals. My dog, Winston, never thinks about that. He never thinks about his meaning and his purpose. And he's never off into error or trying to get in touch with himself, you know, and just sort of validate, you know, his dogness in some way. No, it's not animals, but man, men and women, he has set eternity in their hearts. He has put within every human being's heart a curiosity about meaning, a curiosity about purpose, a curiosity about tomorrow. And that prompts us to probe. That prompts us to search and to be intrigued. And it's just that there's a catch. Catch is that he yearns to be a part of eternity, to get all that. He feels the need in himself and to make his work something eternal. And yet he's trapped. Trapped in time. Cannot find out what God has done from the beginning of end. They can't make the pieces of the puzzle fit. They're not able to discern any plan or any pattern to all of it. So there they are living with that curiosity that God put there and this striving and this need to know and the curiosity and the jumping into one pursuit and the other pursuit. Causes some personal friendships in my previous church. There was this tracking of the things that Madonna has gone through. There were some personal relationships there connected to her. And it's been sad through the years, you know, to kind of track. And one person we know knew her personally. And we talk about how there would be times at night where this person could hear her back in her bedroom crying at night. Why? No meaning, no purpose. And you see this progression of stuff that she's gotten into along the way to what she's into in the last few years, this religious movement that she's in that's a mixture of Judaism and some other things. Can't make anything fit. What's going on with her? Same thing. Searching, curious, and yet confused, bewildered. I mean, God's plan is so eternal, so vast, so comprehensive that they'll not find it on their own. They have to come to know personally God Himself. So I guess the final point would be this. Since God is the one who's done all this, and God's the one who's superintending it all in some way, even the things I can't understand how He superintends. And since He owns tomorrow, and since He's the God of eternity, and He put eternity in our hearts, we can't find out about tomorrow and eternity without Him. In other words, our pursuit can't be for meaning. Our pursuit can't be for purpose. Our pursuit must be of Him. And if we pursue Him and know Him, the meaning and the purpose can come. So every season of life comes at the proper time. We're not in it alone. It's a picture of God's providence. And since it's eternity that God has put in our hearts, then we need to pursue the God of eternity. You can say it this way. Since eternity includes the end, and the curiosity of what's going to happen out there, we can't really deal with life until we've dealt with death. Can we deal with death properly? So I ask you tonight, are you ready for the moment when God will stop time? And there'll be no more seasons, no more events. If you're not absolutely sure that at the breathing of your last breath that you don't have heaven as your eternal destiny, if you're not sure of that, then you can't live in the present. And the answer is Christ. In Christ, we know God. And therefore, we know hope. We know assurance, we know forgiveness, and we understand the eternity that's been set in our hearts. Let's pray.